Welcome to The Apple of Truth, a podcast that, despite our original intentions, has grown into pure Neil Gaiman appreciation.
So let us take you on a journey through everything Neil himself has ever written.
Currently, we are covering The Sandman and hope to enrich your dreams and haunt your nightmares.
I'm Vero.
And I'm Lena.
And this is Season 1, Episode 7, The Doll's House.
And I did find songs with the same title, but sadly I did not find a song that was particularly matching or fitting for this episode. If you, dear listener, know one, please let me know, because it made me really sad that now, after 6 episodes, number 7 does not have the title with a matching song.
Well, technically, we are getting into the second half of the season, so maybe some things are changing.
I do not like change. And because I do not like change, we have our established order of things that we do here. So after our banter introduction, we go into summaries. And I kept it very simple because I literally just said, we get to meet Rose Walker, who's a vortex, and also a group of serial killers who are Corinthian fanboys.
Yeah. That is very simple. See, I thought you were going to say, and because I don't like change, I didn't like this episode. And that was going to be very upsetting to me because I actually really enjoyed this episode.
Oh yeah, so did I.
So, you know, short introduction from you is leading us directly into the Thursday Times. And I enjoyed Morpheus this episode.
Because he was not in there that much?
No, I actually do like him, unlike you. But the specific moment that I did enjoy most, there was a couple of moments when I was like, hello. I really enjoyed the last scene he's in, because the moment Rose shows up in the dreaming and she shows up in the hall and he looks at her and there is just so much going on in his face. So it's like surprise, expectation, serious, troubled, curiosity, all of these things brought together. And I find that very attractive because it shows me that it's an emotionally evolved being.
I have to say that I do prefer this dream, because now that he is in a happy relationship with his BFF, he is much more human and much happier. So yes, but very obviously I did not pick a dream moment because...
Wait, let me just give me a second to be shocked. Oh my God.
Because someone is finally back in this episode, and not only is he back, but also he is so hot in this episode, especially right after he just hooked up with Rose's apartment sitter and is very obviously planning to kill him. And then he gets the notification about the copycat kill, which is the only reason why he doesn't kill him, because he has to take care of that first. And that was so hot.
See, I didn't read it as he was gonna kill him.
Oh yes. He fucked him and then he would have killed him. Oh yeah, duh.
That's what I expected when he first entered the apartment, but it wasn't what I was getting on that part of a scene. But curious.
It's called having an entree and a main course. Or did you forget that most of his victims are naked?
You mean the one victim we've seen so far?
In this episode, we get several other references as well. So,
yes.
To me, it was very obvious that he most likely had intercourse with most of his victims.
Okay.
So, yeah, to me, it was clear. Have sex first, then murder. And the tension right before that was literally the hottest thing in the entire episode.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Also, I'm not the only one who thinks he's incredibly hot. So did the apartment sitter.
I have never said that he's not hot as long as he's wearing his glasses.
Which apparently he is during sex, which, wow.
Would you like to tell me anything fun or fucky about this episode?
Fucky? Wow, that sounds like a pun for fucked. But let's go into the facts and fucks. Director for this episode is André Bayes. I apologize for butchering the name, who will also be the director for the next episode. His credits include over 10 other shows or movies, but nothing I'm familiar with. Writer for this episode is Heather Belson, with her only Sandman episode. Among other things, she has written 2 episodes of American Gods and 4 for The Walking Dead. This episode is the worst rated episode of season 1, with a rating on IMDb below 7 stars.
Interesting.
And when looking in the comments on IMDb, people had issues that there was not enough dream in this episode, that it was convoluted, that there was too much going on, that it was badly written and badly shot. The only thing I agree with is that there is too much going on in this episode. It's too many storylines happening at the same time.
Yeah, there is a lot going on. But
I actually enjoy this, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Because I like being slightly challenged and have to pay more attention to things, but... And again, I'm me, so yeah. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, there is quite a bit IMDb facts and funs we're gonna include here. Hopefully, maybe, probably. When the Fates speak to Rose Walker about names, they mention that she should be glad she meets them in their current roles. You wouldn't want to meet us as the kindly ones. This is a reference to the Greek Erinnaes. While their name means kindly ones, they are better known to English speakers as the Furies. A later collection of the Sandman comics is titled The Kindly Ones, as Dream has considerable dealings with them. Did you know who the Kindly Ones are?
Yes, because I've read Percy Jackson before, and I also read a lot of Greek mythology growing up.
Good point. Forgot Percy Jackson. Yes. When the Corinthian is walking around Rose's apartment, he sees a photo. Did you recognize the person in the photo?
You mean Judy?
Yes, so you did recognize that it's Judy. Did you also remember why she would have a photo of Judy?
Not at the time, but I puzzled it together later. So I watched the episode and then I was going on my doing stuff that I needed to be doing, cooking, preparing stuff, you know how you do. And out of nowhere, it was in the back of my mind and just, oh my God, we met Rose before.
And when did we meet her?
We met her 2 episodes ago in the 24/7, and she is the friend on the phone that talks with Judy.
Exactly. So this is why we have the photo there and everything.
Yes.
The diner where the co-chairs of the planning committee meet to discuss options for the replacement guest of honor is called Mike's Drinks and Burgers. This is undoubtedly a nod to artist Mike Dringenberg, who illustrated the Sandman issues 1 to 20, including the Doll's House story arc from which this episode plot and name are derived.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I absolutely fucking love this.
Amazing.
The red and gold costume donned by Jed is a comic-accurate rendition of garb worn by the hero Sandman in his third Bronze Age iteration. He initially wore a fedora, gas mask, cloak, and business suit when he appeared in the 1930s and 1940s as a crime-fighting mystery man, but traded up to a gold and purple-colored union suit to better fit in with the spandex-clad adventurers who became popular in the 1950s through 1970s. The character was revived by Jack Kirby in a red-yellow costume for a brief run from 1974 to 1976, wherein costume seen in Jed's Dream. So yeah, apparently superhero Sandman wearing colorful spandex. I was not aware of that.
Interesting. Very confused about this one.
I mean, it's all stuff, you know? In the opening scene featuring Rose and Jed Walker in 2015, Rose picks up a pair of Batman and Superman toys, while Jed is wearing a t-shirt featuring the character Static. All of these characters are from the DC universe, although Static was originally published by Milestone, of which Drame slash the Sandman are a part of. So it's very meta. After Rose and Gilbert, who was played by Stephen Fry, have fought off Rose's attackers, there's a poster on the wall behind her with a large pink heart. This is an Easter egg for fans of the Sandman comic book series, as the thing that makes Rose the Vortex is her heart.
Aww, that's
right?
Very cute.
It's very cute. Then, of course, we have some actually moments, because this is what we love IMDb for. This episode repeatedly refers to action taking place at Cape Kennedy, Florida. There has been no such place since 1973. Cape Canaveral was named Cape Kennedy upon the president's death in 1963, but only retained the name for 10 years before reverting back to normal. The NSA launch facility, officially known as Kennedy Space Center, is on a nearby Merritt Island. So Cape Kennedy, not a thing. Cape Canaveral, the actual name. And another actually moment is Miss Rubio says the foster parents are getting $800 a month for raising Jed. Florida caps reimbursement at $478.60 for a 12-year-old child.
So that's supposed to be like a really good amount of money they're getting. I wonder why they wanted to keep him.
So that concludes the facts and funds. Let's see how much of that makes it into the actual episode.
Okay, so this episode is so filled with things and small references that it made it pretty much impossible to write a full-on previously on. Because if I were to do a full-on previously on, we'd be sitting here for the next 10 minutes.
So
I have chosen to go very briefly and touch upon just the one thing that brought us all here in our previously on the Sandman. Dream has been captured by Roderick for 100 years, which looks like it was arranged by one of his siblings, Desire. His realm has been nearly destroyed, even though Lucien did what she could, but now he's back to his former glory and more.
Former glory and actual smiles.
I know, right? Ah. There's so much happening there. So, with the little snippet of previously on, I think that we're going to get through all of the details of the previously on throughout the episode when we actually get to the specific references. Jumping straight in,
we go to the dreaming.
And Dream is picking up a book that has very obviously Rose Waters' dream diary written on it.
Did you notice the stack of books beneath it?
Nope.
The Corinthian.
Oh no!
All of them. Oh, all no. of the books are the Corinthian.
Does this mean that these are his dream diaries? Does it mean that he is also dreaming? Or is he just...
I think that is a documentation of all the nightmares that the Corinthian has basically like worked in.
Ah, okay.
It's literally his work track record or something, in my opinion.
Okay. That makes sense, yeah. It's very
but
cool.
I literally wrote down the question as to what those books might be. Was it just me or did the music feel very different?
I didn't notice anything, so I'd say that it was very on brand for dreaming for me.
All right. Maybe when you feel bored, you could go back, because to me it actually felt very, very different. Mm. And it matched the different vibe I'm getting from Dream now that he has reunited with his BFF. And is now in a happy relationship and everything, you know? Because I feel like having a relationship with an endless and having one date every 100 years is perfect timing.
Sounds good enough. Dream starts reading Rose's diary. And it brings us back to 2015, to Florida. So we're going back in time, even though that feels like it's in the future because it's 2000 and I'm 10 years old.
For some reason, I wrote down 1973, and I got so confused later on why she isn't older and why Jed is only 12.
Okay.
I do not know why, but I wrote down 1973.
No, that was 2015. 1973, something happened 1973. I don't know what.
Yeah, and I'm so confused.
No, so this happens in 2015, and we go back in time and we watch a dysfunctional family trying to leave the abusive father, which seems like,
yes,
and him not letting them all leave. And I hated that.
I love that we don't even see him because he doesn't deserve to have a face.
Yes.
And I kind of understand the mom at least saving one of her kids.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't seem to be coming with, because she's helping she's helping her son unpack, and Rose is basically already leaving.
Miranda tells Rose to go wait for her in the car.
To me, it kind of also gave me the vibe that the mom would have been like willing to stay behind as long as she can basically send her daughter to safety. So I know it doesn't work out because in the end there's the apartment and the estate and la 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 la. But yeah, having to pick and choose if you are gonna subject both of your children and yourself to continued suffering and abuse, or if you're gonna leave one behind and save the other. It's an impossible choice, in my opinion.
It's terrible, and I can't imagine making such a choice.
We have a lot of quick back and forth moments in this episode. So we're now already changing location again, and we're popping over to Desire's lair.
Desire's house, body, both.
It's a lair.
All three. Yes, it's definitely a lair. And Desire keeps talking and talking and talking. And we have seen them in the previous episode talking to their sister or to their twin. And we finally get to meet and confirm who that twin is. And it is, of course, Despair.
The queen of Despair. And She looks exactly like in the comics. It is fucking perfect casting.
Love that. Yeah, they have this whole conversation about Dream. And I feel like Desire is very much obsessed with Dream for some reason. I don't really know why, because I don't have any history.
Desire literally says why.
Because Dream thinks that he's better than them? No, that's not a valid reason.
Because dreams are merely echoes of desire and despair. According to Desire, Dream is a consequence of their two realms, and as thus not deserving of a realm.
Okay.
It is a consequence, not its own thing. And so Dream should not exist, or at least not have the arrogance of wanting to have his own domain.
Okay. Which to me still sounds like unreasonable obsession.
I mean, it depends on how you define things, because dreams tend to be born out of things that move you. And so that is usually love and desire and hopes and everything. So one could make an argument for dreams are not their own thing, but born out of something else. But since we equate hope and dream in several episodes already, I think in this realm, it has to be its own thing because it is more than just dreams. It is hope, which by the fight is literally the unbeatable and strongest thing and everything. So that also makes sense why then Dream would apparently be one of the stronger siblings, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
But it also makes sense why some siblings might be jealous.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they're viewing it in a little different way.
Exactly.
I agree with Desire that Dream is self-important.
Oh, yes.
However, I also think that unlike Desire, Dream is very self-concerned with his self-realm and with his self-self. And he doesn't really pay attention nor care about his siblings, except for Death, which we saw last episode. But I think that's one of the reasons why maybe Desire is so obsessed with Dream, because not only he is this powerful and not only he has his own realm and everything, but he's also not paying attention to Desire. And Desire, as we have seen, is also very self-obsessed. And I feel like they don't really understand how they are not in front of Dream's eyes at all times.
Also, Desire is literally Desire. So I feel like once the minuscule seed of wanting something exists within Desire, it can only be an obsession. I don't think there's any in between. Either it doesn't exist in their consciousness, or it is an obsession.
From 0 to 100.
And I'm pretty sure that when it first started, Dream did not handle it well because it is not his nature.
Gasp. What? Dream not handling something well?
And I think that after that, it simply spiraled out of control. And since Desire and Despair are twins, I can also very much see the two of them make it exponentially worse just by being in the vicinity of each other.
Echo chamber!
Because Desire makes Despair want it more, and Despair makes Desire obsess about it more in a way of like, ah, I'm the worst, ah, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which, huah! But that was actually not the part that I focused on, because there is a bomb dropped in this scene that overshadowed everything else.
Okay.
And that is this time or the time before that. And then we learn Nada was a mistake.
Oh, yes. That is most definitely dropped in this scene.
And that makes so much sense, especially given the whole Nada falling in love with Dream and pursuing him into his realm, and then Dream becoming obsessed with her and everything. It's just, it makes so much sense.
It's just Desire 101.
Yes. And then, of course, feeding potentially of the despair of Nada being stuck in hell and everything. So yeah, that was okay. It makes a lot of sense, but also, what the fuck is wrong with you?
It's a very good setup scene, because it didn't feel like an information dump, but it did give us a very interesting start to the episode.
Oh yeah.
So we learn about Nada, we learn about the existence of Vortex and it being a she. And for some of you who are paying attention, you may have already started connecting it with the fact that we just saw Rose. But what destroyed me this scene was the moment when Despair starts digging the fish hook into her face.
Yeah, the self-harm was horrifying.
I could not. It was so bad. Oh my god, so bad.
I found it curious, though, that we do learn that apparently the vortex is bringing everything and everyone to her.
Yeah.
When at the end of the episode, she is actually going to dream, not the other way around. So that was interesting to me. Because I expected after this line that for some reason Morpheus would come to her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's coming to him.
Yeah. I mean, he's been monitoring her, so it makes sense to me.
Yeah, but it sounded like she was drawing everything into her.
Yeah, because Merriam-Webster defines vortex as something that resembles a whirlpool.
Or did you not know what a vortex was?
I couldn't exactly imagine it. I knew it was a thing, and I just didn't know exactly what it was. And that just means that everything is slowly getting closer and closer, and it's drawn into the circle, and she's in that circle.
She's basically a black hole, you know? Just
basically. Yes. Consuming everything and everyone. Now, in the next scene, I was just staring at Rose, and I was like, why does she look so familiar? Not really being able to place her face. But I was trying to see if I know the actors, or what was the story? Couldn't figure it out for the fucking life of me.
And then you rewatched the episode and then you realized it.
When I started rewatching, I already knew where I knew her from.
Okay, but so this is a leftover from your first round.
Yes,
you're taking.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I hadn't realized how much time had passed because I wrote down the wrong time, I was like, huh, she's still looking for her brother after quite a long while. No, honey. It was 6 years. Not that long.
Yeah.
Which is also why I was very confused that no one was willing to tell her where he was placed, because I assumed he was a grown-up by now.
Oh, yeah.
And so all of this is just very confusing to me.
Oh, that's so funny. When did you realize that you got the year wrong?
When we learned that he's 12. And I was like, huh? Oh.
Okay.
Because she infers that she is not as young as she does look, and it's annoying that people do ask for her ID and everything. So it's like, okay, so she does look young, but she's actually a lot older. It's like, okay, this all still works. And then it's like foster lady going like, oh, what would you do with a 12-year-old boy? And me going like, what?
In the scene where they tell her that she is a young lady and she says, I'm not so young, she actually says she's 21.
Yeah, so maybe she was like, you know, 12 when she left or something. Like, that still kind of worked, you know?
You found a way.
But okay, him being 12 did not work, so.
In this scene, we learn that she doesn't have a job. She has lost her mother and she's trying to find her brother. We learn that when she's on the phone call, and then she starts talking to her friend,
whose name I didn't learn for the longest time. I was like, who is that? Lita. Something.
Lita. I think it's Lita.
Yeah. Lita Hall. And which?
Lita Hall. So like Lita Hall. Yeah, so Lita says we should go. And Rose is like, oh, I don't know if I should be leaving the country when I have no job. And then she's like, well, you're getting paid going to England. So what are you talking about? Like, you're literally getting money every day for going to England. Like, what is she on about? Like, it's the easiest way to live, to just go to England. It's so weird to me. I just didn't find Rose very smart for the longest time.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, for the whole episode.
I am not a fan of Rose. I'm going to say it now so I don't have to complain about it.
She's very immature, let's put it that way. I did like Lita, though. She is very pretty and she seems very nice.
Nah, I keep waiting for her to fuck shit up because Hector.
Well.
Yeah, I don't trust her.
Well.
Sorry.
I liked her in this scene. I think that she was very caring and nice. But then after we got introduced to the concept of Galt at one point, I think that's the name that we were given because I am the worst at writing things down, apparently. And I am, from that point onwards, convinced that Lita is actually a shapeshifter who is guiding...
Who's Galt?
Yeah.
What? Wait.
That was my assumption for about halfway through the episode.
Nah.
Although it doesn't really fit, but like, also I don't trust that bitch now. Also, I love her. But also, I don't trust her. So I'm kind of with you, but not yet.
Lita is not a shapeshifter, but I actually really like that theory.
I mean, I think that it would be fun because I'm convinced it is somebody close to Rose. So why not somebody somebody who has been by Rose's side for years at this point.
Especially since Jed apparently got severed from the dreaming very early on.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make sense for Gaunt to reinsert herself into Rose's life once she leaves her brother.
Yes.
So if you turn out to be right, this is going to be amazing. Like, yes, I'm here for it.
I'd be very proud of myself.
No, I'm absolutely fucking here for it.
Okay. So yeah, hence a little bit of a roller coaster of emotions there going between she's so hot and nice and kind to Rose.
There must be something
iffy. There must be something wrong.
She can't be this perfect. There's just no way. But we do leave the apartment at some point and we are in the airplane. They're flying business class because it's being paid for. And also because life is too short not to enjoy business class.
At the end of the scene, Lyta cheers with a champagne and she mentions somebody that I got very confused what she's talking about. But then she mentions, I think she mentions Hector, and then she mentions that it's her husband who is now dead.
Yeah, there were so many names in the beginning of this episode that it did get a bit confusing. Because here's Rose, here's Chad, here's Miranda, here's Lyta, here's Hector, here's this, here's that. I'm like, what?
Here's Carl.
And then on the other side, you got, here's Gaunt, and here's Fiddler's Green. And it's like, what?
It was a lot. But for a very brief moment, we pop over to the dreaming and Lucien is doing a census for a dream. And I love that. Very funny.
I kind of feel like Dream should be able to feel his creations. But then again, there are creatures living in the dreaming that are not his creation. So yes, it does make sense.
Yeah. We got the list of the creatures that live in Abel's house. And it's Abel, House of Secrets, the Bottle Imp, and something unspeakably nasty in the basement. And I kind of want to know what that is.
I mean, there's always something unspeakably nasty in the basement. That is the point of a basement. Do you not have this standard fear of basements?
I think that we just, because we never had a basement, and I still don't have a basement, I just kind of bypassed that. I don't like seeing basements on TV shows and movies because there's always some sort of a murderer there.
Yeah, and that is where that comes from, because of this age-old fear of dark subterranean places, basically. Because it is below ground, it is dark. Most basements have these horrible stairs where you can reach through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just straight up terrifying as itself. And then, of course, there are so many creatures and monsters that live in the dark. And because most basements don't have natural light, it is just like the natural hiding and living ground. And obviously, since I was like, oh yeah, of course, the nasty thing in the basement. But I was not familiar with the Bottle Imp.
Oh, me neither. I just kind of took it as it went.
The Bottle Imp is an 1891 short story by Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson, usually found in the short story collection Island Nights Entertainments. In it, the protagonist buys a bottle with an imp inside that grants wishes. However, the bottle is cursed. If the holder dies bearing it, his or her soul is forfeit to hell. And obviously, the bottle is unbreakable.
Nice. I thought it was the other way around. I thought it was an imp that stole bottles instead of an imp that is inside a bottle. But I love that. I actually do love that. And of course, he nearly forgot Gerving sitting on his shoulder the whole time. I know. But also Gerving.
No, he called him Goldie. As I remember Gerving. Yes, I do. But no, Goldie. But Goldie is very cute, but also still very small.
Baby Goldie.
I was not happy with Lucienne in this moment, and I'm very glad that in the end it turned around, because she's very dismissive right here.
Yeah. There's a few things that Lucienne does throughout this episode where I was like a bit, okay.
I feel like Lucienne is struggling a bit with the return of Morpheus because she got used to running everything.
Mm-hmm, doing her own thing.
I do appreciate that later on we get the call out that she actually still runs everything.
Well, yeah. So she seems very single focused on the census and she doesn't want to listen about Vortex. You're right. But this actually made me afraid that she wasn't gonna bring it up to Dream.
Oh yeah, I was so worried. I was so fucking worried.
Yeah.
I mean, he already knew, but I'm still very happy that she did bring it up.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting scene. But generally, Dreaming has a very different vibe than it had last time we were there a little bit more.
And I feel like there is a different music in the background. So you are the music person. Go back and listen to it.
I've only noticed the music towards the end of the episode, which was still the same music, but it was a lot more instrumental, because so far what we had in the dreaming was very small, very subtle, single linear types of music, and now it's a little bit more like a symphony. So that was the one difference that I noticed.
To me, it felt like, until this episode, all the music is in minor key, and now everything is in major key.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, before that, it sounded sad and dull and subdued and now the dream is a happier dream. The dreaming is a happier place.
Yeah.
So
I think we're talking about the same thing, but in our own
words. Yeah, because I'm not the music person, so please go back and listen to it and tell me if, from literally scene one, we have the difference.
Okay, will do. Captain. Now, we are back on the plane, and there is a random dude
yes!
that Lyta is talking to and is telling him all the details about Rose's life. And I was like,
"Yeah,
do we trust this person? Do we trust Lyta?"
Who is that? Oh, wait, is that Hector? Oh, then she must be dreaming. Huh, at least she's self-aware in her dream when she mentions that she's literally talking to her dead husband. So I was like, ah, okay.
I did not realize that it was a dream until she literally mentions that he's her dead husband. Because up until that point, I was like, who is this random fucking person? Did I just like miss somebody boarding the plane with them? Or what's going on? But she says this really kind of a beautiful thing. When you lose your parents, you suddenly realize that it wasn't gravity keeping you on the ground. Which then she kind of broadens up a little bit more to not just a parental figure, but somebody who is this important and this significant in your life is somebody who is going to help ground it.
But she seems to limit it to blood relations, and I have an issue with that.
Oh no, she says she talks about him as well.
Yeah, but
in a relation to her.
Yeah, but a husband is your next of kin in a way, like your spouse. And I take issue with the, it has to be a spouse, a parent, a child, or a sibling, which is also why I have an issue with her, because later on Unity is like, well, that means you are also my family. And Lyta is very much like, no, I'm not. Which I get being defensive because, lady, I don't know you. But I feel like Lyta is defensive because, no, we're not family. But Rose also isn't really family. And I don't like this because I am a strong defender of friends are the family we choose for ourselves. So I do not like the my only tethers to this life and earth are my spouse, my kids, my parents, and my siblings. So
yeah, actually, when I was watching this, I thought that this would be your opinion. That's why I was like, but she said a husband as well, so not just blood relatives.
Basically,
but yeah,
legal first connection.
I agree with you. That was something that I would like to expand. But to me, maybe she didn't say it, but I would like to take that statement and put it blanketly as a found family. Whomever you consider this close to yourself.
This is how I would like to see it, but I don't think that is how she sees it.
Maybe not how she sees it.
That's why we don't like her.
There is a reason we don't like her and why we find her suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how we can take it and embrace it and rephrase it for ourselves. Because I genuinely think it's a very beautifully formed thought.
No person, no creature, no human is an island. So we do need connections to keep ourselves tethered to this life. Yes. But what and where these connections come from is a highly debatable thing.
Before we move on to the next scene, after Lyta wakes up, there is suddenly a woman sitting instead of Hector.
Yes.
And she is reading a book.
Oh.
And I would like to put it on our list because I don't think we're able to figure out what book it is, but it's a big chunky boy. And I would like to ask somebody what the book was, because there is no coincidences in Neil's work.
True.
And I don't believe it's something that's is not relevant.
Very good point.
I believe it's something relevant.
We will put it on the list. Absolutely loving that.
Thank you.
Absolutely loving that. We leave the airplane and we go into the dreaming. And aside from the fact that I thought prodigal meant prodigy, this is where the language lesson starts this episode.
Oh my God, it's so much.
So many words in this that I had never heard before. And I did look all of them up. And if I missed something, I will edit this episode in a way that it seems like I looked it all up before. But before we go to the language lesson, we see Morpheus. And he looks so happy and he doesn't look broody at all. And he's actually really hot. And if there was no Corinthian in this episode, then I would have had a hard time picking what was the hottest moment. Because Morpheus even seems a little bit playful in this episode.
Yes, he does. We first of all see the realm and it is fixed.
He did his work.
We had this debate. We don't know for a fact if it was him actually doing the work or just the fact he set things right and he now has his power back that repaired the realm. But the realm nonetheless is fixed.
I think he has to do it because remember episode one when he is stripped of his power and he tries to raise all the broken pieces up and then he's exhausted. And he literally said he is now more powerful than he has been for eons. So I think he literally came back home and was like, oh, and just popped everything into place, right? You know, like just an instant.
Yes.
So yeah.
I 100%. I see it in front of my very eyes. It's beautiful. It is colorful. It is great. It's like fireworks, but backwards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like the great. Pew, 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 pew.
Pew, pew, pew.
Yeah, exactly. That is the perfect, wonderful, mwah, chef's kiss. Mm. Lucien is there with the census book, and we have a number how many creatures are living in the Dreaming. Did you write it down?
No, I expected you to do that.
11,062 creatures.
That's not that bad.
I love that it's 62, and we are missing three.
Mm-hmm. Three major arcana.
So we get three names. We get Galt, a nightmare who is a shapeshifter. Do you know what a Galt is?
I don't know what a Galt is.
It is a...
I know, it's lighter.
No, it is a thick and heavy clay, which makes sense as a shapeshifter because...
So you can reshape clay.
Yeah.
I also love when they mention the name, the one of the windows reformed into the image.
Oh,
and it's so
such
beautiful.
Such a good effect.
Oh, love that.
Do you think if there were four arcana missing, there would have been a fourth window suddenly?
Yes, 100% that would have happened. Because Dream is just that powerful. Yes. There'll be three in one shot and four in the other. The second Lucien would say, oh, it's four major arcana missing.
And it would look like it was always four. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when we were in hell and Lucifer was wearing the white outfit.
Oh yeah, then suddenly black. Yes.
Black.
Oh, you've never watched Kung Pao. Your clothes are now black. Sorry. It's funny when you watch the movie.
Okay.
Then, of course, the second major arcana is the very Corinthian himself. So we're not going to be talking about him. But the third is Fiddler's Green.
Who the fuck is that?
And that was my issue because, as far as I was aware, Fiddler's Green is a where, not a who.
Because it also is where. Like, the window transforms into a little park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... Fiddler's Green is an afterlife where there is a perpetual mirth, a fiddle that never stops playing, and dancer who never tire. It is a kind of afterlife for sailors who had served at least 50 years at sea.
Jesus, who survives that long in the sea?
Yeah, not all mentions of Fiddler's Green are positive. Some are quite negative, but it basically depends on what you read and where you go. But Fiddler's Green is a location, not a person.
Okay.
And so when Morpheus says that it's curious that Fiddler's Green decided to leave, because he is actually his own, like, he has his own domain and his own autonomy and everything. Apparently, in the Sandman, Fiddler's Green is both a realm and a person, just like Dream and the Dreaming, you know?
Interesting. That's very cool.
Yeah. So I'm very curious if we're going to learn more about Fiddler's Green, both as a location and as a person.
We also, as you mentioned, get some language education here because Dream calls him a Vavasor of his dominion.
Did you know what a Vavasor is?
No.
Well,
did you?
I didn't, but I looked it up because I was like, a word?
A
vassal owing allegiance to a great lord or having other vassals under him. So it's literally the in-between. You have the over dude, you have the plebs, and then in between you have a vavasor.
Okay, so I had to actually also look up vassal because I did not hear that word before.
Have you not read King Arthur and shit like that?
Why would I read that shit in English when I have perfectly fine edition in Czech? It's a person in the Middle Ages who receives protection and land from a lord in return for loyalty and service. So it's basically like a knight.
A knight is a vassal. Not really. Yes, a knight is one potential vassal. Yeah, but you don't have to be a knight. You could just be like a lord. Exactly. A lord would be a vassal of a king.
All knights are vassals.
But not all vassals
are... But not all vassals are knights.
Yes. A lord can be one. Gotcha. A lady could be one, depending on maybe if she survived her husband. Yes.
As long as they return with a loyalty and service, they can be a vassal.
And so... Interesting. The whole loyalty and service thingy is obviously... Huh? Okay. Why did he fuck off then?
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for joining us for the Apple of Truths Sandman Dictionary lesson.
I mean, we did not do the most British word of the episode this series, so I feel like we were due a language lesson, and we shall continue. Now, Lucienne, thankfully, is sharing the gossip with Dream, but Dream already knows about the vortex.
Also, Lucienne's approach to it, like, I understand she's being very protective of the realm, but also calling Rose it.
Yeah, because she doesn't know that Rose is, that the vortex is a girl.
Until Dream tells her, then obviously she changes it up. But she also is asking Dream to do something now, and Dream is very adamant about, I cannot do anything now because she is not a direct danger to anybody, and I am not allowed to interfere. Which, on one hand, yes, but also, on the other hand, he's the only Endless who doesn't actually do that. Maybe death is within playing within the rules.
We don't know that.
All the other ones seem to be, or at least Despair and Desire, are giving me the vibe that they don't exactly play by the rules.
Literally, aside from Desire, because I don't think that Despair is taking an active part in all of this, because it was all Desire's plans. But I think aside from Desire, we have no hints that any of the other Endless medal.
I guess so.
So Desire is the fuck up. Yes. I mean, have you looked at them?
No.
Obviously, you haven't.
Well, the thing is there. I didn't love Lucienne's approach because I understand why she is trying to convince Dream to do something about Rose now, but also I don't think it's her place, and I guess she needs to argue for it in order to fulfill something inside her. But I also, because she has this approach, I'm not completely sure if I can trust Lucienne to not do something on her own because of the later interaction when she asks basically Matthew to tell her the news before he tells Dream. I'm a bit on the fence about Lucienne this episode, and it starts over.
Pumpkinhead tells Matthew to tell Lucienne first.
Yeah, but Lucienne agrees and thanks Matthew for agreeing to do so.
Yeah, and I'm here for that. Lucienne is thankfully sharing the gossip about the vortex with Morpheus, but Morpheus already knows and is honestly slightly dismissive about the whole shebang, which feels arrogant because from everything that we do know and already have learned about a vortex is that it is a dangerous thing. So Morpheus kind of shouldn't be as dismissive, I feel.
I think that he is monitoring the situation.
He's doing what he can, yeah.
But mostly why I don't see him as arrogant right now is from his reaction, don't think that a vortex has to necessarily become a problem.
Ooh.
And he doesn't want to jump into it unless it's absolutely necessary. Because first of all, that's the rule. And second of all, why shouldn't Rose have a beautiful life, you know?
Maybe there basically is like a self-fulfilling prophecy part in it, that only if you become the danger to the vortex becomes a danger to you. And so usually by trying to prevent or early on destroy a vortex, you actually create the problem. And he's actually being smart about it because now he's happy.
Wouldn't be the first. He actually can be smart, as we learned before.
Yeah. Good point, good point. And this is also the moment where we get yet another word that I didn't know, but I didn't look it up instantly because I did all my language lessons after I watched the entire episode. And annulet actually gets explained within the episode, so I didn't have to look it up.
I still don't understand what it's supposed to be, because they say that Rose is an annulet.
Yeah.
While annulet is supposed to be a fucking ring. So how is a human being an annulet? How is Rose a ring?
This is something that we will learn, but an annulet is literally just the ring, not as it has to be a jewelry ring, but it is the round circle thingy, and a vortex also is a circle.
Hmm.
And okay, so, maybe. You know?
Mm. Yeah, I guess. I feel throughout this scene, though, that Morpheus is very much intrigued with Rose. I think that he is watching her not just because she potentially could become danger, but because she is the first vortex at this age, I believe that he says. And he hasn't seen one there for millennia, essentially. And that means that he has the unique opportunity to watch it develop and watch her live her life and see how it goes and what lives she touches.
In this scene, most importantly, at the very end, we have Morpheus not just interacting with Lucien, but we have him look so smug. And I really do enjoy this version of Morpheus. And I also think it is good that we did not get too much of this different version, because this way we had some time getting used to the new version. And so next episode, I expect we will spend a lot more time with Morpheus and Rose, because now they have made contact.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he's also going to turn back into a bit more dour dream, because interacting with a human, like, you know, gotta keep up appearances and such.
We'll see.
And then we're going to, like, settle in a middle ground.
Okay. Now, at one point, he conjures Rose's face into the sky.
Yes, because she's dreaming right now.
And she opens her eyes, and it seems like she has heard the entire conversation, which I feel like that has connected to the fact that she's a vortex.
Probably.
I don't think that's normal.
And I also think that Dream is not aware of this at all. So this is going to come as a surprise, because otherwise he wouldn't talk as openly about all of this.
It's possible,
maybe it's deliberate. Yeah. But most importantly, at the very end of this scene, we learn that Matthew is going to stalk Rose. And I was like, huh, is this the reason the episode is rated so low? Because it's a Matthew mission? But turns out it's actually not all that about Matthew.
Yeah. I was also wondering, because Lucien specifically words it as somebody needs to go watch her in her waking hours. And Dream says, well, I can't leave right now, or I don't feel comfortable leaving
Which,
right now.
Which, good for him.
And, oh no, I agree with him. But I also was wondering, is Dream who she meant, or did she mean herself?
No, I don't think she meant herself, because Lucien is never the person to leave the dreaming, I feel.
I feel like a lot has changed.
But that is literally the purpose of the ravens in general. The purpose of the ravens is to be sent into the world, because as Dream says, and I will see what you see. Literally, the ravens of Dream are the ravens of Odin.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I was just wondering if there was some sort of a situation where Lucien is feeling a little uncomfortable having Dream back, so she tries to get out of the house, if you know
I don't
what I
think
mean.
She would have minded if Dream fucked off again. Yes, very much so. We go back to Sussex, England, we finally go to Sussex, England. And at this point, I was still very much confused as to what all of this is about. Because on the first watch through, I feel that there is a lot of information and a lot of, like, parallel storytelling and everything. So it is confusing. But since it all ties up so nicely, I don't mind that I was confused in the first third of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
We arrive there, we have the, oh, what's an annulet? I actually dreamed about an annulet. Here's where I actually learned Lyta Hall's name. I was like, oh, that's her name. Which, finally, I could write down a name. And then we go inside the room and we meet Unity Kincaid. And I was like, should I know her? She feels so familiar.
Why does Unity sound familiar?
And yeah. I was like, isn't she the one who didn't wake up? Oh, yeah, that is she.
Did you remember before they tell you? Wow, well,
like,
fucking done.
3 seconds before.
Mm. That
I was very proud of myself, because this
I am very
is
proud
one
of
the episodes I knew nothing about, so whoop, whoop.
Okay, but Jesus, something very uncomfortable happens in this scene, or rather is talked about, and that is the fact that not only she was asleep, but she also gave birth to a child. And I was like, I know that this is a whole, like, a supernatural concept, but where she's like, oh, I was with a man with the golden eyes and whatever, but like...
Which you completely didn't clock, but we're not going to talk about that.
That's not important right now. Important is that the implication of being in a coma
and suddenly being pregnant, because in reality, there is no such thing as conceiving within a dream. So yes, outside of the setting of the Sandman, this is highly disturbing and sadly a thing that actually happens, like sexual assault on comatose patients is a thing. But thankfully, this is a supernatural world where Unity was dreaming, and we're just going to assume that she had the ability to consent in her dream world because she lived a full life while dreaming. So
yeah, she lived a full life with this man, if I understand it correctly.
For my happy thoughts, I'm going to assume that within the dream, she had full control over her choices because everything else would be incredibly icky.
Yeah. Regardless of the knowledge of supernatural, it still makes me uncomfortable. Oh, a situation like this.
It also is like weird as fuck because like, who are you? Why are you doing this? What is the end game? And then I was like, okay, wait, you got pregnant and you got Rose here. You're going to be her grandma, right? And, oh no. Okay. Great grandma. So I was off one generation.
How old is Unity? I would like to talk about that at some point because I kept asking myself that question because she fell into a coma the day Dream was captured. She was 12 years old.
Yeah, and then 100 years went by and now he's out.
So she is 112 years old at least.
But I don't think she's
very mobile.
I don't think you aged the same while suffering from the sleeping sickness.
I also wonder because she is like, I don't really know how nutrition works when it comes to this. And I feel like it's interesting that she can walk after not being mobile her entire life. I feel like she would not have any muscle mass or very little.
Very simple in my opinion to answer this because her parents had a lot of money. And that means that I assume her comatose body got the best care that was possible, which included physical therapy, which is the reason why she did not atrophy completely, because you can work the muscles and everything with like electrodes and physical therapy and massaging. And the same goes for nutrition. There are ways to make sure that the body maintains enough nutrients. Plus, even though you're sleeping, if you put enough movement on the body, you will not have like the bed sores and everything. And given the fact that she makes no secret out of the fact that her family is fucking loaded, this is my answer to why. Because her parents could afford perfect care for her.
All right. Well, okay. I'm not super 100% satisfied with this answer because I feel like you are correct, but I don't know enough about the science for my brain to embrace that right now.
Plus supernatural sickness. So the combination probably.
Of course. She was being very physically active in her dreams, as we know.
We don't know like how much the dream would affect the physical situation.
I wonder. So she had a baby when she was in the dream. So was that the same baby that then was born in a real life? Or was it a different baby?
We don't know.
Then, yeah, that is just something that I'm like curious about because I didn't think of that before.
That we don't know. But so she is the great grandmother of Rose, which means that Miranda, the mother, is her granddaughter, which means there is one missing generation.
Yes.
And also, there were two other women in between Unity and Rose, and I don't understand why neither of those two was the vortex.
I suppose there has to be the correct amount of circumstances. Maybe it's because... No, that's
Dream
also,
was still
that's
in captivity when Rose was born.
Yeah.
Because that would have been my assumption that because Dream was free.
Unless the vortex can only be activated when Dream is
so
free.
Both Miranda and the missing woman had the potential to be the vortex, but it wasn't activated. So, like, the Slayer is the Buffy. I want to put this on the question list if the in-between generations had the potential to be the vortex.
Yeah, that's a good question. And shockingly enough, Lyta is not overcome with joy about the reunion. She is very kind and very nice.
And she's a good friend removing herself from this. Like, I appreciated this.
Oh, yeah. I am all for her removing herself from the situation. But her face was telling me, oh, damn, I'm no longer a sister orphan. She now has somebody and I still have no one.
There was, and I was actually impressed acting-wise with the actress because I didn't know her. But I was impressed with the performance because in this split moment that you see her face, you can tell the happiness for her friend and the jealousy regarding the situation and the sadness of losing her. So it was impressive and maybe I interpreted, but to me it was visible. So I was here for it.
Oh, no, I saw the same thing. So, clearly, if both of us saw it,
then
and one of us is colorblind,
then we share a delusion. We share a delusion. We share actually several delusions. So yay, this is why we get along so
well. We also share a brain cell. So
sometimes we really do share a brain cell. It's amazing. But speaking of sharing.
Sharing is scary.
We go to yet another storyline that in the beginning feels completely unrelated, but at the end of this episode ties beautifully together with everything. And I remember this storyline from the first audio drama.
Oh,
the serial killer convention is a thing in the audio drama. And it is so funny. How long did it take you to realize what they are?
When I was 100% sure this was serial killers is when they start talking about the Corinthian. I had a suspicion before. They literally talk about it as it's a music festival. So they lose the family man, which is the headliner. And then they start throwing out different names. So they say the Moon River. They say the Candyman. And I was like, the Candyman?
Candyman can.
Doesn't sound like a... I have a bad feeling about the Candyman, generally. And then they slide towards the Corinthian. I'm like, oh no. Oh no. This is bad. But also, I love the concept.
It already was really bad when it's like, how old do you think the waiter is? Too old for you? I was like, ew, ew, ew. I was like, oh, thank fuck, he's just a serial killer, not a pedophile.
Well, Porcinella's does.
No, actually, I think he just likes to kill them young, you know?
Yeah, they're more tender that way.
Oh, maybe he's a cannibal. Ooh, I like that. Oh. I mean...
Why would I say that?
Veal is tastier than beef.
Yeah, so we have this serial killer convention understanding now. And now we have the revelation. We had this conversation a few episodes ago when the Corinthian was talking to... What was her name?
Ethel.
When the Corinthian was talking to Ethel. Yes, because I have a brain of a fucking goldfish.
Generation goldfish.
So when we were talking about this the other episode, when the Corinthian was talking to Ethel, and you were trying to convince me that we only saw one dead body and therefore he only killed one person. See, I remember that. However, now we have a full-blown confirmation in your damn face that he is indeed a serial killer and he's been at it for years and years and years.
130.
Yeah. See, from before Dream got captured.
I really enjoy the fan boy group for the Corinthian because I'm one of them. Even though I don't moonlight as a serial killer in my free time because ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah, it's I think it's a really fun concept and I feel like I've seen this before in a couple of different TV shows and it's always really fun. So I am very excited if we actually get to go to the convention because as a convention people
absolutely looking forward to the actual convention.
It is indeed a serial killer convention and they're looking for a headliner and the lady suggests that the way to interest the Corinthian is to do some
basically to bait
there.
Him, which I'm here for her.
Oh, I love her.
She's a go-getter.
She and she is greatly, greatly obsessed with the Corinthian.
I mean, she's
me. But the boys don't really agree.
Yeah, because they're scared. They're little scaredy cats.
I mean, I don't blame them because as one of them says later on, if somebody copycatted me, I would find them and make sure they never do that again. And I'm like, yeah, good reason not to do it. But this lady doesn't wait. She just goes.
Yeah, but she does it in the next scene when we go back into the restaurant. Because first, we have to pop over into Rose's apartment where there is a knock on the door. And speak of the devil, it's the Corinthian.
Do you know what happened here? They said his name too many times.
Ooh, they said Corinthian, Corinthian, Corinthian.
Yes.
Sadly, there is no knock on my door. I'm very disappointed.
No? You can't hear that.
I cannot hear the knocking, sorry. Discord is filtering that out.
Yeah. Wow, Discord doesn't want you to meet the Corinthian of your dreams.
Oh my god. I would fuck that creature instantly. And he could keep...
And then you would die.
Keep wearing his glasses.
So, the Corinthian...
Let's move on!
...meets Carol. The Corinthian meets Carol, and Carol is the house
sitter. He refers to himself as a house sitter. And he's so cute and gay.
I mean, who's surprised he's gay? Nobody. Literally not a single person.
Because he's the cute gay.
But, yeah, he's the obvious gay. But in my notes, I just wrote down, Carl does have the right idea. Yes, Corinthian is hot, but also goodbye, Carl.
Yeah, I basically made peace with the fact that Carl was going to die. Also, I never wrote down Carl's name. To me, he was just a house sitter.
I noticed when you were naming out the people that we met
and
by name.
And I skipped Carl. Yeah, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Carl, king of ducks. That was very, very different.
And when you were talking about your hottest moment of the episode, you mentioned Corinthian. With the house sitter.
Yes.
Not even cared enough to... You cared about the scene, but not about the guy.
As cute as Carl is, the Corinthian is hot. And hot will always trump cute. Sorry.
Okay. No, it's fine. Carl, nonetheless, goes, well, she should be back in a week. Do you want to wait? And opens the door.
Ah, I need to take lessons because my sapphic flirting is shit. So I need to take all the notes I can get from any kind of flirting and then try to translate them.
Yeah, that was actually very good. Good on you, Carl.
Yeah.
Hope you have fun.
He very obviously did. But we pop back into the restaurant, and as you already implied earlier, Lady Serial Killer is a go-getter. She didn't wait. She just went and did it. So it's on. And after she did it, we move back to Unity and Rose and the house in Sussex, England. And we meet some familiar faces.
Yes, we do. Rose leaves Unity's room for a second to go find Lyta. And she hears some noises.
And she goes investigate because why wouldn't you?
I mean, this felt like a perfectly safe place and she's 21 and dumb. So
mostly, and she's dumb.
Why wouldn't she? But she hears the maiden, the mother, to groan. And they are so
I love them.
This is so good. See, but this interaction, the way they talk to her.
That was terrifying because the fact that they call her sister already infers the relevance and standing of Rose. And yes, she doesn't really know who and what they are and she doesn't have the capability of understanding all the implications. But this is terrifying.
Mm-hmm. It gave me the vibe that the Vortex is somehow connected to the Fates, which would kind of make sense. And I was wondering if there's some sort of a family relation or if it's just a wording that they use for a fellow powerful creature.
Either all supernatural beings are related and this is simply one of the many ways to refer to each other, or there is a specific familial relation between the kindly ones and the Vortex. But we have way too little information about the Vortex itself to make any kind of connection or assumption.
So at this point, the Fates start telling Rose things.
Yeah, because she asked the wrong questions, but they still tell her, which is wild.
They need her to know. They are trying to tell her things, but they can't exactly go out and flat out say.
But that is something they usually don't do. So that in itself, again, is terrifying that they name drop the Corinthian.
So they say, beware dreams and houses.
Which later we see a fucking doll's house.
I understand. Houses? Is it the doll's house? Is it the house that she moves into in Florida?
Ooh, the B&B.
Because that's creepy.
I didn't consider that.
You know.
Okay, I thought the doll's house. Because it's the title of the episode.
Yeah.
Huh. No, but you got a really good point with all the creepy residents in the B&B. That didn't even register on me.
Occurred to me.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, good point.
So she asks, what do you mean? Which is the wrong question, obviously. So they say, you're asking the wrong questions. We could have warned you against the Corinthian, told you about Jet and Morpheus. The way they phrase it, and it's the Fate, so it needs to be phrased very specifically. They don't call Morpheus a threat, which is a good thing for us as a viewers, because it means that I don't have to be worried to root for him and love him unconditionally. Aww. And I like that they managed to name drop the Corinthian, because we know that he wants Rose at this point already.
Yeah, because he's already looking for her.
And she will indubitably come across him very soon. So, you know, at least she's gonna hopefully remember to be on a lookout and be aware.
It's wild to me that a player like the Fates is nearly breaking rules just to drop this on Rose to give her a fighting chance of surviving the Corinthian. And that is wild. wild.
Also, the whole idea of, like, make sure you don't trust the Corinthian, because he is going to come up with a way to tell her, you are helping me, so his dream, who used to be my employer,
love the frame,
can be out of business because I need to be independent, and he's taking
that
away from me.
I love that framing, by the way.
It's so good. It's very good. And everything that she learns, I unfortunately don't think that she will remember or make any sense of it until it's a little bit too late.
Because at the end of the episode, she literally is meeting Morpheus. There is a chance that Lucien might call him that in Rose's presence, as to not call him Dream, you know? And then that would basically enable her to go like, wait, the Fates said the following things, and then Morpheus could be like, okay, honey, here we go. So that is my naive hope, you know?
Yeah, let me be dreaming.
And hoping, which apparently is the same thing, which still not happy about.
Enjoy your dreams.
We have her waking up because fucking Lyta interrupts, which, fuck that shit.
See, yet another reason why I don't trust Lyta.
Yeah, there is something fucky with her. Maybe she's the piece of clay.
Exactly.
We go to the tea room, or we go to have tea, and Unity does this all of us had interrupted lives moment when all of them talk about, like, the people they lost, the connection, the familial connection. And this is one of the moments where Lyta once again shows that I don't like her, because she does not seem to be even slightly on board with potentially having found more family.
I think Unity says in full, life is a series of interruptions and reconnections.
Isn't Rose who says that?
I thought that Rose says...
Oh, you know, Rose says all of our lives were interrupted, and then Unity says life is a series of interruptions. Yes, 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 yes.
And reconnections, yeah. Because she is trying to reconnect
Rose. And she is extending the opportunity to connect with Lyta, and Lyta is basically like, nah, bitch, no, I'm good. Which, no.
I'm good. I don't even miss my husband. Whatever. We had enough time together.
I'm going to keep obsessing with grief instead of moving on to the next stage. But I like Unity.
Unity now bestows the amulet, the ring, onto Rose. Which is funny because she uses literally the word
amulet. Because she's old as fuck.
And Rose, yeah. And Rose is obviously being like, ooh, wait a second. I just heard that. So maybe she will actually take anything that the Fates just told her to heart, but I don't hold a lot of hope for that. I'm not gonna lie.
We will see where all of this goes, but now we have a mission. But before we can go on to the mission, we have several stops on the way. The first is go back into Rose's apartment to Carl and the Corinthian. And the first thing we see while he's getting dressed, that he's still wearing his glasses. And I'm like, did he leave the glasses on during sex? Yes, he did.
Yes. The Corinthian finally gets dressed to the displeasure of Lena and Carl. And he picks up a picture of Rose. A candid picture, printed out candid picture of Rose that's just lying on the shelf. Who has that? I do not understand.
I don't have a single candid picture printed, but I did make friend calendars with collection of like festival photos and stuff. And there are some candid pictures in there, because sometimes you do look a lot better in a candid photo than in a post photo.
Yeah, I agree with that. But like, it's not like I have them lying around.
Maybe she really liked this one photo of
herself. It's 2021. Everybody has digitals at this point.
I don't think she is. I think she's very old-fashioned.
Probably. Takes after her mother. So Corinthian starts walking around, and as he's walking past the next shelf, we see a picture of Judy that we have met in one of the previous episodes. But then, of course, Carl tries to get some seconds.
I mean, wouldn't you want to go for a second round?
Depends. Was it very, very good?
Very obviously.
In that case, probably.
But sadly, the second round with the Corinthian is death, which Carl doesn't know.
Well, the question is, would he sleep with him again before killing him? And instead of orgasmic part, the Corinthian was just like, pop out the eyeballs?
You remember that in my definition, he eats them out because his eyelids have...
Yes, I do. But he then talks about the thumb thing. So,
oh, right. Sad.
Yes, I have been soothed by the convention of serial killers.
No, I honestly think that if the ping on the phone hadn't happened, he would start making out with Carl, and in the process of making out, but before undressing, he would kill him. I don't think he would have sex a second time, because basically he got his rocks off and now he's gonna get his other rocks off.
That's fair enough. He looked intrigued to have some more fun, but that doesn't necessarily just
mean sex. Like fun, depending on where your motivations lie.
Yeah. But what I find very funny is that he has a Google alert on his name.
Of course, he's a narcissist.
True. I didn't consider that part. But
like, that was one of the least surprising things to me.
It was so funny to me. I couldn't fucking deal with this.
Love this, because this has to be a modern thing. Like, this cannot be in the comics, because I don't think back in the Sandman days, Google Alerts were a thing.
Very unlikely.
So I really like this, like, putting this into the modern world. Mm-hmm. Carl gets saved by the ding. And the Corinthian leaves.
Ding-a-ling-ing. He does. And he leaves him with his card. And instead of saying, call me or leave me a message or whatever, he says, give Rose this because I want to talk to her. And I think that must be a little hurtful to Carl, but not as hurtful as eating his eyes out would have been. So I think that he's still good.
I feel Carl is a kindred spirit for me. And yeah, it's sad if you don't get a second round of mind-blowing sex, but there's always more sex.
Yeah, I think that he is given the vibe of, like, not really attached. Yeah. Just
I feel like Carl
enjoyed,
and me,
so he would like to repeat.
We enjoy the things and experiences we get, and we don't mourn the not experience we don't get, you know? So, yes, would he have preferred a second tumble in the sheets? Absolutely. Will he think about this for more than a day? Absolutely not.
Yeah. We finally go back to dreaming.
And we meet a character we've seen before. Did you remember his name?
No.
Who? Pumpkinhead Man.
Oh, no, I don't remember meeting him before.
At first episode. We have him.
Oh, when we were going, we were flying through
Jessamy.
Dreaming. I have forgotten that.
I think back then we talked about him and him having a name and la 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 la. So, Sorry, Merv.
No, it's okay.
Yeah,
Merv. So, as a matter of fact, Matthew still hasn't left, because there's so much happening in this episode that we haven't just gotten to that part yet.
He's still being debriefed so that he can go on his mission.
Lucien goes like, oh, her mother is dead and her father is dead. And then she's like, oh, poor baby. And I was like, I feel like the characters in this TV show have had a lot worse fates than this, than just dead parents. So I don't really understand where that is coming from.
I think usually Lucien doesn't pay any kind of attention to the loss and fate and life of humans, you know? And now that she's like actually looking into this, it's like people who don't care in general about the state of the world, and then they watch this one video about starving children or homeless dogs, and then they're like, oh, look at this puppy! And it's like, yeah, but in general, you don't care, you know? But because the music is there and the advert is done really well, they're suddenly like crying over this one dog.
Yeah. Well, and then Lucien says there is a brother and someone else. And I, at that point, was thinking that she's talking about Lyta. But no, of course, she's talking about Unity. But she doesn't really understand the relationship according to what she says there, because she says someone else.
I think I completely missed that.
Well, there you go. That's why I'm here for.
Okay, I need to go back there. Because I was so distracted with Pumpkinhead Man showing up that I kind of didn't really pay attention to anything around that.
About, what's his name?
Murph or Mervin?
Marvin. About him, I don't like him.
What?
I find him interesting. I find him cool. I find the CGI being very interestingly done. But I don't like the way he dismisses Dream as the ruler of the realm.
Yeah, because he's salty that Dream was fucking gone for a long time. He's being petty. I relate.
Yeah, but he's supposed to be a dream.
Maybe he's a nightmare. Did you think about that?
He's
a fucking scarecrow.
Oh, maybe he is.
His body is made of sticks. He's wearing the overall thingy and he wears a pumpkin hat. He's a fucking scarecrow.
He is a pumpkin hat. Yeah. But he's cute. How is he a scary nightmare?
You do not watch enough scary movies.
On purpose. Thank you very much.
That's why you don't understand things like the unspeakable terror in the basement and pumpkin
hat. I have enough fears, real fears in my life to add to them. I don't want to walk through my life terrified of everything. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that you should watch more scary movies, even though there are very few scary movies that I will make you watch, which reminds me once again, I need to get on this and force you to watch movies with me, which means we need to establish like a movie night.
Yeah.
But this is why I'm like, this is why he is the way he is, and it makes sense to me. But also, it kind of makes sense that you don't like him, because I think he is more a nightmare, and so it's not for you.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But yes, we have mentioned this before. I'm not loving this whole, you need to tell Lucien before you tell Dream, and Lucien not setting it straight.
It makes sense to me, because Lucien didn't leave.
I know, but Lucien at this position should have said, Dream is the one who can actually stop this from happening. He should know first.
No, because you need... Because Dream is a really bad boss, and you need to manage him, and you need to package things a certain way to get the result that is
You need to manipulate him.
Yes, very saying. Much so.
I don't think so.
And I do, and thus I am very much with Lucien, and I am also very much with Marv, because Dream left.
I understand Marv. I am pissy at Lucien.
Loyalty for Marv is towards Lucien, and Lucien did run the entire thing. So Dream needs to re-earn Lucien's trust in his competence.
But I don't know if a situation like this, where all of them can be completely fucked,
especially a situation like this, cannot be risked on Dream's potential or perceived unreliability.
Oh, the fact that they are butthurt because...
They are not butthurt, they're traumatized.
Well, yes, but like also... He is their master, yes. And Lucien is nothing but pretending to be super loyal. And my issue is that she doesn't seem to understand. She doesn't seem to phrase his words. My problem here is that she isn't as loyal as she likes to portray herself to be. And I don't have an issue with her not being that loyal. I have an issue with her pretending to be super loyal and Dream is my boss and whatever.
No, she is loyal to the Dreaming. Not to Dream. And there's a big difference.
Well, clearly. But also, without Dream, Dreaming will cease to exist.
Which is why she needs to manage Dream. Because her first duty, as far as I understand her values, is the preserving of the Dreaming and its creatures.
To me, this situation was more about the ego.
See, I don't see any ego in Lucien. That's why I don't mind.
I think this is the biggest difference.
Because she never makes it about herself.
I kind of feel like this is about herself. The way when Marv says, oh, we all know that you run the Dreaming yourself anyway. If she in fact didn't have an ego, she would say, you know, that's not
true. No, because
true.
It is
you
true.
You know, I can't do this on it my own.
It is.
Not, because she can't run it by
herself. The CEO does not run the company. He is responsible for the company. But the people who actually run the company, and they have to report back to the CEO, and they filter what parts and bits of information they pass on, because they care about...
So if the CEO dies, the company is going to continue working exactly the same way?
Mostly, the top level really doesn't care, and that is a problem. And I don't think that Dream has re-earned the belief that he cares about his creature.
That's fair enough, but we have a tangible proof that if Dream is not there, and his not around, the Dreaming will slowly fall apart and die, regardless how capable Lucien is.
Yeah, I'm not saying Lucien is planning on getting rid of Dream.
I think there is the fundamental difference between our views at this scene is the fact that I see an ego and you don't. And I think that's all we need to say to this.
Dear listeners, write in and tell us if you think Lucien is doing it for herself or if she's doing it for the Dreaming.
Yes, tell us.
We leave the Dreaming. And we go back to the not-existing Cape Kennedy, Florida, and we meet yet another person with yet another name, because we meet Hal, who runs the B&B. And then we meet Ken and Barbie, who are very self-aware that their names are hilarious. And then we meet Chantal and Zelda. And then someone mentions Gilbert. And I'm like, who are all these people? What is happening?
Yeah. I am so incredibly suspicious about this whole situation. And yet again, proof that Rose is fucking dumb and immature and child. She literally calls up a random person and tells them her entire life story.
I think that there must be something about Hal that makes you tell him your whole life story. So I don't blame Rose for that.
But hence why I thought that this is the house that the Fates were talking about.
Because all of these people are so colorful and weird, it seems too obvious, you know? Like, if it was dangerous, it wouldn't be as in your face that it's weird. But yes, I also wrote down this B&B is scary as fuck.
how to put this? I don't specifically recall what this is, but I feel like there is a specific legend where, as you said, there's something about Hal that makes you tell him everything. I feel like there is somebody like that would be like a collector of weird or colorful beings or human beings, or we don't even know if they are human. I feel like there is definitely something supernatural about the BNB. What is it? And if it's a threat, I don't know, but something is off. And I don't trust anybody except for Stephen Fry.
You trust Gilbert just because he's played by Stephen Fry?
Yes. Unfortunately, that is the way my brain works. I see Stephen Fry and I just want to die because I love him so much.
We have this scary as fuck B&B and we check in there, but then we leave the B&B after meeting all these random people and we go to the foster lady person. And this scene is horrible on so many levels because rationally, I get it. She cannot and she's not allowed. But emotionally, I'm with Rose. Be a fucking human. This entire scene could have been resolved incredibly easily because the foster person says, would you be able to take care of a 12-year-old boy?
The social worker.
Yeah, not whatever. Says, would you be able to take care of a 12-year-old boy because you don't have a job and financial security? We literally just learned that Unity is fucking loaded. So where's the fucking problem? Why isn't Rose's answer, yes, actually, I could, because our, Jet and my great-grandmother actually really wants to be responsible for us, and she's fucking loaded because she's the heir of King Kate Sugar. So shut the fuck up and give me the contact information so I can make sure Jed, before he's even more traumatized, can return to his family and enjoy some one-on-one time with his great-grandmother before him and me inherit all this money. Yeah. I'm so upset because that is the obvious solution.
But this is exactly what we had in her first scene when she's like, oh, I don't have a job.
Yeah, but she has Lighter right next to her, which is another indicator that Lighter is fishy as fuck because Lighter is smart.
I agree. She is also the one who pointed out to Rose that she's getting money for every day that she's going to be in England. So that's technically like a job, right? No, this is very, very, very upsetting. Also, then one more very aggravating red flag thing is when the social worker tells Rose, oh, I think that you'd be happy to know and I can tell you that the people who took your brother in were friends of your father, her abusive father. And she still says nothing. Not a word.
It's absolutely fucked. I hate it. Rose is a fucking idiot. And Lyta is fishy as fuck. But now we go to pretty things. Because now we go to a drag bar.
Yeah.
And Hal is performing there. And Hal is gorgeous. And also, what a voice.
Right? So, did you recognize the song?
No. I mean, there's a lot of mention of Rose. That's the only thing I clocked.
It's a song from Gypsy the Musical.
Ooh, okay.
And it's called Everything's Coming Up Roses. And I think this is a very deliberate choice. And whether it is a conscious choice by the producers or Hal.
Maybe both.
That is a good question. Because not only it's called Everything's Coming Up Roses, and it's a lot about Rose and roses because of the whole story behind the musical, but funnily enough, it starts with I've Got a Dream.
Oh.
And I don't think that's a coincidence. I feel like Hal thought, what if Hal is the green thing?
Fiddler's Green.
Hold on. What if Hal is Fiddler's Green? Because he is creating an environment. Yes. And the B&B is the place that he created.
Okay, I actually really love that.
Right? Yeah. So we might not need to be worried about Hal. Although, why did he leave the dreaming in the first place is still
unclear.
Because
he also might have issue with Morpheus.
Authority?
No, with a lord over him that proved to be unreliable, and thus now his loyalty is wavering. So instead of undermining him, he simply straight up left, which is a more honest variant.
Yes.
But absolutely. It's also abandoning your people in the dreaming. So maybe all the other people living in a B&B are actually creatures he brought with him.
Oh, that is not a weird idea.
Maybe he brought his
like
most
that.
Important people with him.
Because he is loyal to his people as much as he's loyal to his monster. As much as he's loyal to
his monster.
He used
to be loyal until he was disappointed.
Or once.
And then he left. And maybe he brought his most loyal subjects with him. I like that theory.
I like that
theory.
I like that. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well done, us. Once again, I'm very proud of us.
I am here for it. We have a quick scene change in the sense that Rose gets a call and tries to answer it by leaving, which very respectful, but also very stupid.
I mean, it was very loud inside, so
I'm pretty sure there would have been an in-between area, but story-wise, we need her to leave the place.
Also, I'm sorry. Why would she go outside through the back door?
Because it's probably the closest area to leave and she did not want to miss the call. But also, this to me implies that she did not call Unity after the meeting with the social worker. Which, fuck you, Rose.
Well, yes. Or maybe she did. Maybe this is not Unity calling her. Maybe this is some sort of a supernatural being trying to...
No, I don't think so.
Lure her outdoors.
I don't think supernatural beings, even in this day and age, use cell phones to manipulate you.
Except for Corinthian.
No, I honestly don't think so. Like, seriously. I think he's going to use a ruse and shit like that, but I don't think he has, like, the hacking skills. You know?
Okay, that's fair enough.
Nah.
Now, basically, she gets lured out and she gets locked out as well because the guy that was having a smoke in the back alley closes the door behind him when he enters the club. And since this is the bar that you have to press from one side to open the door, and the bar is only on the inside.
Yeah, because it's an emergency exit.
Exactly. She's not getting back into the club through that door. So I find it a little stupid. But let's chalk it up to the fact that she's 21.
She has proven to be annoyingly unaware. Let's put it that. Yeah, but she is annoyingly unaware of implications and situations, which is also being proven in this situation because... Yay, two muggers show up, Gilbert to the rescue, and she then charges in. I did enjoy that she apparently knows how to fight and she actually disarms one of the muggers. So, yay, I was here for it, but still... And at the very end of this scene, we get a Chesterton reference, which I feel is an author that keeps coming up in Gaiman's works.
Oh yeah, is he the one who wrote the...
G.K. Chesterton is the fairy tales do not tell children dragons exist. Children already know that dragons exist. Fairy tales tell children that dragons can be killed. And I feel like Chesterton, in one way or the other, is one of the base things that keeps being referenced and mentioned and inferred in Gaiman's work. So I really enjoyed this moment of yet again another Chesterton reference. So I'm here for it. Anything else from You for the Seed, aside from the fact that Gilbert is played by Stephen Fry?
First of all, I yelled when I realized that it was Stephen Fry. And when I saw him, I was like, now that I see his face, I remember knowing he was on this, but I completely forgot.
I didn't know he was going to be on this, so I was very surprised. Yeah.
Isn't it so good? Oh, I was like, this voice reminds me of... oh my God, it's Stephen Fry! Yes. And I just love him so much. The fact that he plays Gilbert is great for me because now he's the only trustworthy person in that entire house for me. And I'm sorry, this is just always going to happen because it's Stephen Fry.
Okay.
Yep.
We go back over into the dreaming, and here we learn that Lucien is unable to find any documentation, reference, information, whatever, on Jet. Not only because he doesn't dream, but she cannot even find anything about him in the waking world. And that seems to be an aberration. But how did this not come up before?
This is my big thing here. I figured that if they have a vortex and she learns about her by reading about her and she literally says there were parents, both of them are dead, and then there is a brother and somebody else. Why didn't she do a research into the brother?
I think we're seeing the research in real time because remember the last scene we saw, Matthew hadn't even left yet. So I think there has very little time passed.
No, but Matthew... have watched Rose for an entire day and most of the night, and then he flies back.
Lucien is trying to find anything on Jet, so I feel...
I'm pretty sure that he tells her, and only then he tells her that she's looking for the brother, and she's like, oh, brother, let me check where he is, because if he's missing, let's find
him. Yeah, then it's even more weird, but I saw it as that she has been trying to figure out where he is.
Yeah.
And that would make more sense.
Yeah,
but
unfortunately,
yeah.
I don't think that's the case. It would make more
sense.
Well,
we shall see how it goes. But there is not much else in the dreaming for this episode. So we go back to my favorite plotline, which is the serial killer meetup. And they kept doing it. Like, each of the three of them has now done one copycat for the Corinthian kill. And good things come in threes. And they did all three of it. I mean, he already was on his way after the first one. So the lady got it done because that's what us women do. And he came. And seriously, that moment when they're having this conversation and then he just is like, that's why I use my thumbs. And I was like, ha, 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 hi.
Great. Well, this is luckily, and I mentioned this before, I don't know if it's going to stay in. Luckily, this is the moment where we learn that he actually uses his thumbs and not his eye teeth to remove people's eyes. Yeah, terrifying. And I am actually shockingly calmed by that image.
Because it's more normal. Also, I'm surprised because in most movies that I watch, when you have the combination of thumbs and eyes, it's actually to pop the eyes, not to scoop them out.
Well, that depends how you're going to get around it. If you like pop it straight in, it's a great way to pop them. But if you go into a certain...
I don't feel that a thumb is the right tool for that. I feel like an ice scooper would be a better tool.
I feel like ice cream scooper would be a little bit too sharp because
of course you need to practice a bit, but it would be perfect to cut off the optical nerve.
Maybe.
So I'm team ice scoop thingy.
I mean, I don't really need to know this. I'm team, let's not do this at all.
No, that's not an option.
We have very obvious moment where the woman is so clearly the most obsessed with the Corinthian.
She is this close to climbing him. And I'm like, yeah, me too, girl. Me too.
Yeah. And he's enjoying the attention, obviously, because he's who he is.
And he's not instantly killing them. So he very much is into this.
I think he's curious about what's going on because I feel like copycat is the highest form of flattery. Essentially, that's how Criminal Minds once put it.
But imitation is also the poorest form of flattery at the same time. Well, it depends on it depends on the execution.
But he is very curious about what brought this on. And they tell him about the convention. And he says, a gathering of like-minded souls all sharing the same dream. And I was like, oh no, oh no, oh no, fuck, he just made it
creepier.
Oh no. Creepier, yeah.
No, I was very much here for it. And I'm so happy that the Corinthian is on board. Because to me, this means that next episode, we get the actual serial killer convention with the Corinthian as the main guest. And we shall see how he gets Rose to be his plus one. We go into the penultimate scene with Cape Kennedy and the dreaming. Because we start with Rose in Cape Kennedy, but it is very obvious to me that she is dreaming and she's walking.
See, to me, it could have been two different things. To me, she could have been woken up by her roommates conspiring because of the muffled voices.
Yeah, good point. No, to me, the way the camera, because unlike many comments on IMDb, I actually really did enjoy the camera work and direction on this episode. Because of the camera work, to me, it was obvious it was a dream. Because once again, angle and stuff. And so she's walking and then she is literally walking into the dreaming where Morpheus and Lucienne are having a conversation. And this was second place for hottest moment because of how Dream's mantle is laid out around him on the stairs and the way he's sitting on the stairs. Like that is I'm going to kneel right in front of the stairs and be like, hi.
Lie down on the ground and just go, hello. Can I please touch your foot?
That's why kneeling, you know, so you have free hands.
I think it's good that Lucienne immediately goes to find Dream when she realizes
because
that
she's loyal, even though she's skeptical. Quiddy.
Yeah, whatever. But they talk about why and how this could have happened. And the last nightmare that Jed has is of Galt.
Yes, the clay creature. Coincidence? I think not.
Exactly. So they have this conversation and Rose walks in on them and I was just like, ooh, Dream, look at you.
Yeah, any normal person would have said that, but because Rose is Rose, she's like, yo, what the fuck is going on? Which also fair, also valid.
A listen, if any of us was sleeping and just walk into a dream, we wouldn't be like, hey, yo, what's going on? We would be like, oh no, please take me right now on these stairs.
It's like, Lucy, and fuck off and take the book with you. Or maybe draw what we're doing. That's also fine. With this, we go into the final scene. We are on a random street and we have Jed, who is easily recognizable, running on the street. And I was like, okay, this is not good.
Yeah, because I was like, this feels like it could be a dream, but we now know for a fact that he does not dream.
Exactly. Which why it was clear this is not a dream. This means he's running away. And if you have a 12-year-old boy run like this without a backpack, without anything, on a street with nothing there, he is running from something really bad. Because he didn't prepare. He didn't wait for the right moment. He ran because he had no other choice. And then it just keeps getting worse.
In a shocking turn of events, in fact, his foster parents are terrible people. Who saw that coming?
But we have this whole interaction, and the lady is his foster mom, right?
Yes.
So I just wanted to make double sure. Okay, good.
Yeah, that's how I read it anyway, because he calls her aunt.
La la la. Yeah, okay. So she tries, but she is obviously terrified of the foster dad, which I don't blame her, but also I do blame her because she's the grown-up and Jed is the child. So in this setting with just the three of them, I do blame her more than I do blame the kid. So at the end, we have Jed being forced into the trunk.
Fun!
And that is the end of the episode. And I have no words, basically, because... wow! I don't understand why this episode is rated so incredibly low. I mean, yes, I do understand because me, there's so much going on and why this is complicated and can I please be spoon-fed? But yeah, it is a bit confusing in parts, but I think the confusion is done in a way that makes it intriguing and interesting, not overwhelming. And for, I think, the second time, I was actually a bit upset. I couldn't watch the next episode right away because this very much feels like a two-parter. Like, I kind of was expecting there to be a to be continued on the screen. Also, last episode, we already started collecting all the questions, and this episode added so many questions. Why is Desire doing all of this to torture Dream? What exactly was Desire's involvement with Nada? Who was the golden-eyed man in Unity's dream who created the baby? And why was Rose's mother not the Vortex, or Rose's grandmother, but only Rose? Why would Gaunt sever Jed from the dreaming? And who in detail is Gaunt? I actually had a lot more questions, which I hope I did ask throughout the episode, because when writing my final thoughts, I did run out of time because life got in the way. And so this is what I'm left with. Whoops.
I'll go on.
Bless you.
You can always edit out the questions from the episode and put them to the end, right? So this was a very eventful episode.
Yeah, that's why we recorded 3.5 hours.
Yeah. It feels like we spent the first half of the season setting up and getting to know characters, so we're not too confused about this shitstorm that is about to rain down on them. I am very much enjoying the attention to detail that we're getting. No small encounter seems to be random, with Unity and Judy coming back and Rose becoming actually a very important player in the game. There is a lot going on. And things are speeding up. So let's get this party started. And with that, thank you so much for listening. You can find more of us on social media. We are on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Instagram.
What other things do we usually mention in these outros? Oh, right. If you don't want to miss out on all the extra bits and pieces in this episode and in all the other episodes, because trust me, especially today, there was a lot of extra material, you need to be a patron over at patreon.com/TAOT podcast and support us. But you do get something in return, which is hours and hours of bonus content. You get other things as well. So do check it out and maybe click that button to be one of us.
One of us. If you don't have the financial opportunity to do this, you can also help us out by sharing the podcast with the people you know or writing us an iTunes review, because that helps, apparently. So this is where you find us. This is how you contact us. And if you want to give us even more detail, please send us an email to sandman@taot-podcast.com. We can't wait to hear from you.
Please write us. We love hearing from you. Thanks. Bye.